Hi, podcast listeners. Ira here. Here's the deal. We need your help. Each week, my staff and I seek out the most interesting scientists in the world, and we bring them to you over the airwaves, on our website, through these podcasts. And you know, we're happy to do it, and we're especially happy that you enjoy it. But putting all of this together is not cheap. So we're hoping that you can pitch in. Point your smartphones or computers to sciencefriday.com/donate to make a gift today. $5, $10, even a buck, whatever you can give. And if you give 50 bucks or more, we'll send you a Science Friday tote bag. Yeah, so that you can show off your support. Now on to the show. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The latest UN climate talks began this week in Lima, Peru. And I know what you're probably thinking. Another year, another talk, more of the same inaction, and disagreement on climate change. Given the history, I was as skeptical as you are. But I've been hearing a slight pulse in the patient lately. The U.S. and China, the world's two biggest polluters, have agreed at least that something needs to be done. And if so, will more countries be willing to come to the table on climate treaty? My next guest is a veteran of these international climate meetings, which he's called a traveling circus. And he's here to talk about what to expect in Lima. David Biello is the environment and energy editor at Scientific American here in New York. He joins us here in our studios. Welcome to Science Friday. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So you've called the talks a traveling circus. Still stand by that?
I stand by that. I think people are taking that a little bit more harshly than I meant it. There is a tent aspect to these talks, and there is the fact that thousands of people fly from city to city to put on a show about climate change. But there's also a very real and important work going on to negotiate some kind of a global treaty that would curb global warming.
What would be a measure of success in this meeting? What would we say, you know, we had some success there?
That they are able to edit down the document that they have, which basically is everybody's wish list, into something a little bit more concise that looks like it can be signed by pretty much everybody in Paris next year, COP21.
Now, every country is able to drop their own commitments this time around, right? It's not a top-down thing.
It is a bring-your-own booze kind of party. And I guess COP21, they'll have reached, the American drinking age, and they'll be ready to sign something.
But you mentioned next year, but that's going to be at a time when the Republicans will be in control of both houses of Congress. Is that going to make a difference?
It is going to make a difference. It'll be interesting to see how exactly it makes a difference. Certainly, many of the Republicans in Congress have been speaking a little bit differently about climate change in recent weeks and months, ever since they won that victory.
Such as? Can you name it?
Senator John Thune, among others, have said that
climate— South Dakota,
correct. He's the number three, I believe, in the Senate. And he has now staked out a position where climate change is probably happening. We probably have something to do with it. And therefore, we probably should do something about it. Now, he's not willing to say what that should be, but he certainly has colleagues in the Senate, whether it's Lindsey Graham or John McCain, who have thought about this before and have proposed, let's say, market-friendly solutions in the past.
Our number 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. Could you really believe, we were talking about this a little bit before, that any kid born today, 15 years after, is not going to believe in climate change or global warming?
I certainly haven't met any. I have a second grader, and they certainly all know what climate change is, or at least global warming, depending on what term their teacher uses. And nobody seems to have any problem believing that this is something that we could do. And certainly the polling, even within the Republican Party, suggests that. Younger Republicans don't see what the big deal is about climate change and think, yes, we ought to do something. We ought to have a constructive response. We ought to have a free market response to this problem. Whereas older Republicans are perhaps a little bit more intransigent on the issue.
What should we look for in the talks in Lima? What are any key signs that would tell us how things are going?
So there are two key signs. One is that basically this Green Climate Fund, this is essentially a big pile of money that's going to go from developed countries to developing countries to try to help them avoid burning a lot of coal. The U.S. has committed $3 billion. Japan has committed, I think, $1.5 billion. And they're looking for a total of about $10 billion. I think they're above 9.5 at this point. If they make it to 10, that's a good sign. Mm-hmm. Number two, if people start delivering, as the U.S. and China have already done, these kind of self-declared goals, then we'll know that we're well on track to a set of commitments that everybody has kind of collectively agreed to. Or if, for example, Brazil or India decide that, hey, if China can do it, we can do it too, that would also be a hopeful sign.
One of the problems with actually getting people to do something about climate change has always been that, hey, you know, what I do today doesn't really affect me all that much. Not my problem. It's a problem for your children's generation or your grandchildren's. But there's a new analysis that suggests that might not be the case, that carbon pollution works its warming ways in just a decade. I'm going to bring on a new guest. Kate Rickey is a fellow at the Carnegie Institute for Science at Stanford. She's the lead author on a study of CO2 emissions out this week in the journal Environmental Research Letters. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Rickey.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Tell us what this means. This really says that CO2 is working a lot faster. Warming from carbon happens a lot faster than we thought.
Right. In this study, we wanted to find a best estimate of the time to maximum warming effect from an emission of carbon dioxide made today. And we came up with a central estimate of 10.1 years after this CO2 emission until its maximum global warming effect.
Because we've heard in the past, you know, it takes 30, 40 years. Where did those numbers come from?
Well, I think the part of the problem is that just no one had done this analysis before. We were pretty surprised. We looked through the peer-reviewed scientific literature trying to find someone who had already published a paper that estimated when this maximum warming was, and we just couldn't find it. What we did find was a lot of statements from climate scientists and climate decision makers in a non-peer-reviewed context, kind of coming up with an answer on this based on intuition, and they were saying things like 30, 40, 50 years. So we decided to take information from the best models that were available out there, already published data, and combine that data to try and come up with, what is actually our best guess according to the state of the science. And we were really surprised, actually, when we found that the maximum warming effect is expected in just a decade.
Just a decade. Is that a good thing?
Well, I guess it
depends on how you look at it. A good thing or a bad thing?
I mean, the basics of how the climate responds to an emission of CO2 are the same in what we find than what scientists were assuming. We know that after we make an emission of carbon dioxide, it takes a while for the climate to warm up because of the thermal inertia of the oceans. And then we know once it does warm up that warming persists for a long time. And so our findings are consistent with that. I think it does change the way we think about and we talk about climate change, though, because if the maximum effect of our emissions occurs in just 10 years, the benefit of avoiding an emission today, it doesn't just accrue to our children and our grandchildren. It accrues to us as well.
And it's also, it's also a way of thinking about it differently. You know, if you're in the habit of thinking, well, if I'm polluting today or I'm not being conserving energy today, that's not going to affect me. It's going to affect maybe my grandchildren. I'll never see it. But if you think, hey, it's only 10 years away, you might think twice or might be more motivated to act about something.
This is also more ammo because we're seeing some of the climate change effects in our daily lives. Some of the recent heat waves and droughts have, in fact, been attributed to climate change. We knew that climate change was happening faster. And so this is yet more evidence that climate change isn't a tomorrow problem. It isn't an end of the century problem. It's a today problem.
Dr. Rickey, anywhere you go from here with the research?
I think it's just a useful piece of information to know and a useful context for the decisions we make today. I think humans are used to making decisions more on a 10-year time scale than a 30, 40, 50-year one. So I think, when we think about politicians making decisions or people deciding what's important to them, knowing that, an avoided carbon dioxide emission today mm-hmm. will see some benefit in our lifetimes makes a big difference in the
way with you.
Dr.
Rickey,
are thinking about this.
Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Kate Rickey is a fellow at the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford University in California. Something I didn't think about, Dave. It came out of the blue, so to speak.
Yeah, it's kind of a motivation to cut more faster, which we already kind of knew, but now we get this kind of added benefit. And maybe that will motivate, who knows, even the negotiators.
You think they pay attention to these little
things?
They
definitely pay attention to this stuff. Every time that I've been at one of these conference of the parties, certainly the latest scientific findings, but even, stuff from environmental groups, governments, all these different reports and findings that come out, they filter into the negotiation process and are, frankly, often used as weapons in the negotiation process.
Well, I was at the first one. That's how old I am. Back in 1974, in Stockholm, there was the first conference on UNCTRA, first conference on the human environment. And, they were doing stuff. They had a lot of interesting exhibits. I know what you mean when you try to refer to the traveling circus, because there are all these little side exhibits, the fun part of the meeting.
That's right.
But you're just struck by how glacial these things move over the years.
I mean, it's kind of unbelievable that it's taking us until COP20 to even agree to do something. We were close with the Kyoto Protocol. And kind of let that lapse, and that's going to go away in 2020. So we have to decide something in the near future.
Now, that was legally binding, and that's one of the reasons the U.S. never signed it.
Correct.
Right? Is the thing that's going to come out of Paris going to be legally binding, too?
It is not going to be legally binding in the same way. Or actually, I should say, that's one of the things that's up for negotiation. The U.S. is still pretty firm in its position that it doesn't want something that's legally binding. It wants something that is a voluntary program, this BYOB concept that I was telling you about earlier.
All right, we're going to take a break. We come back, we'll talk more about the environment, the UN climate talks in Peru, other stuff. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm talking with David Biello, our environment and energy editor at Scientific American here in New York. We'll be right back after this break. In case you just joined us, this is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the UN climate talks in Peru with my guest, David Biello, environment and energy editor at Scientific American here in New York. But I want to end our discussions on a high note. We've talked a lot about the glacial pace, a good word, I guess, when you're talking about the climate.
Perfect.
Because regardless of what happens in Lima or Paris next year, the fight against climate change and global warming has already begun. From the ground up at the local and state level, I'm talking about state and regional cap and trade agreements, tougher emission standards on vehicles and renewable energy. Last year, for example, more solar energy came online in the U.S. than coal did. Yes, more solar than coal. I'd like to bring on another guest as we talk about these change solutions already taking shape today. Robert Stavins is a professor of environmental economics at the Harvard Kennedy School in Cambridge, Mass., and director of the Harvard Project on Climate Agreements. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Stavins.
Hi there.
It does appear that the grassroots is where the change is happening, does it not?
Oh, I think the change is happening from the top down as well. The negotiations have taken a very significant turn. In fact, I would actually call it a diplomatic breakthrough with this China-USA announcement from a couple of weeks ago in the context of the new kind of policy architecture that's being discussed for Paris 2015.
If there's a new president, could that be undone?
Well, some can be undone and some cannot be undone, so let's be careful about this. The U.S. Commitment or contribution, as they're now called because of the preferences of India, the U.S. contribution could be restated by a future administration, but what will be put in place within the United States as a result of existing statutes, existing regulations, existing executive orders, and others that this administration will put in place, regulatory, that is, from now until the end of its term, those are not so easily undone.
I would also note that it kind of looks bad if we turn our backs on our number one trading partner and the biggest holder of our own debt, China, and kind of repudiate a commitment that we've made to them. Mm-hmm. That might be something that a future president might take pause at.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Stavins, let's talk a bit about what's going on in this country and the growth of local efforts to go renewable and to go green. I mean, we've talked about things like the wind tax credit. We watch those wind valley states, you know, from North Dakota to Texas, adopting wind power on their own, giving tax credits locally, creating companies that make their own wind turbines. We've talked about a senator who's changed his view, a Republican senator from South Dakota who's changed his view on wind or on global warming. Are these not all interesting and progressive things?
Also, I think that what's going on in the United States parallels what's going on internationally. So internationally, the new policy architecture is, as David stated earlier, a bottom-up approach. And what's happening in the United States is, to a large degree, a bottom-up approach. Most importantly are the policy developments in California under Assembly Bill 32, which, remember, in percentage terms, is substantially more aggressive than the Waxman-Markey bill was that passed the House of Representatives in 2009. Combined with that, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in 9 northeastern states, and perhaps most importantly, the Obama administration regulatory proposal, the Clean Power Plan, that came out in June of this year that will be finalized subject to litigation next summer. Those are all very, very significant compared to what policy developments had been before that.
Do you think that as we look toward 2016 and everybody's looking already, that the climate is going to be a political topic?
Well, you know, traditionally, going back to the first Earth Day 1970, environment in general and most recently climate change is a second or third order issue in presidential campaigns. It sometimes rises a little higher up in a particular Senate or House race or in gubernatorial mm-hmm. elections. But I don't think that we should anticipate that it's going to be a major issue. Obviously, the proponents of action and the opponents of action will be vocal, but that doesn't mean that it's going to be what's going to be deciding most voters' votes.
That's probably true, but this time around, we might get a question in one of the debates or something like that. Climate change is kind of rising up the ranks a little bit, I feel. And already, you know, Hillary Clinton and some of the Republican frontrunners have been asked questions about climate change by the political press. Now, a lot of that is gotcha, trying to catch them out.
Do they have a follow-up question? That's always
right.
The thing.
But, you know, they're asking the questions. So that's an interesting development.
Can you ever get that into the political debates, you know, when they have all the politics? Can be one question on science. Ever get into politics. Dr. Stavins, you're going to Lima next week to push.
I'm actually going tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning. That happened faster than I thought. What's your purpose in going, and what do you hope to accomplish there?
So the reason I go each year is I direct an initiative, the Harvard Project on Climate Agreements, and we have research teams around the world, China, Europe, India, Australia, Argentina, the United States, working on all sorts of dimensions of the economics, the political science, international relations, and legal aspects of a climate agreement, a future climate agreement that's scientifically sound, economically sensible, and therefore more likely to be politically pragmatic. So I'll be participating in 5 events and also holding bilateral meetings with virtually all of the key negotiating countries because they come to us in order to learn from our research.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the cap and trade ideas that are going on across borders.
So what's going on is that cap and trade systems, whether one likes them or not, cap and trade systems have revealed themselves politically as the preferred approach in most jurisdictions of the world. So the European Union Emissions Trading Scheme in California, in the Northeast, now in China with 6 different local schemes, and they've said in their next 5-year plan they're going to go to a nationwide approach. So everywhere we see these happening. Just as there are advantages to having a cap-and-trade system itself because it lowers costs, so too linking these cap-and-trade systems, or for that matter, linking different kinds of policy instruments across international borders, has tremendous economic advantages. And therefore, both from governments and from private industry, those that have to comply, there's tremendous pressure to link these together. That's one of the key issues for the Paris Agreement, is whether or not the Paris Agreement actually inhibits such linkage or, at the other side, encourages it. And we've been doing work on that, and that's one of the main things I'll be talking about in Lima.
It's an interesting question because we've had some bad experience in the international arena with those kinds of linkages. There's been some gaming of the various systems that were set up in previous iterations of climate change treaties, the Clean Development Mechanism and the like, where, folks took advantage of some of the provisions for linkage to make some money that they didn't really earn. Now, the hope is that this time around you could avoid that. You could learn from that bad experience.
Well, let me be clear. I'm not talking about emission reduction credit systems, an example of which is the Clean Development Mechanism, which, because of the problem that you're comparing emissions reductions to an unobservable hypothetical, what would have happened if you hadn't taken action, are always subject to gaming, and economists like myself are very critical of them. I'm talking about cap and trade mechanisms, which are a completely different animal. They both fall under the umbrella of the phrase tradable permit systems, but they're completely different, and they're not subject to that kind of gaming at all. Mm-hmm.
Well, very true, unless you put offsets into them, in which case.
That's an emission reduction credit system bringing in then. That's what an offset is.
Let's not get in the weeds too much on this. David, one last thing we have to talk about before we go. We've talked about seeing huge amounts of renewables coming online here in the U.S., but it's also happening, I understand, in Kenya, abroad, in other countries too.
That's right. Kenya actually has a very ambitious program to try to be an entirely green economy, and they have the advantage because of the Rift Valley and how close that brings geothermal power to the surface that they can actually implement what is possibly the most reliable form of renewable energy, geothermal, on a pretty broad scale. And it's actually kind of booming the way fracking is booming here.
Fracking
over
has
there.
Given new life to geothermal.
That's right.
The same sort of technique.
Exactly.
Split the rock, put hot water down, or put water and heats it up.
Exactly. It's called an enhanced geothermal system. And basically, they frack for renewable power.
Do they need all those chemicals in the water when they frack down there?
They do.
They do. That's the downside of all of that. All right, gentlemen, thank you for being with us. We've run out of time. Robert Stavins is professor of environmental economics at the Harvard Kennedy School in Cambridge, Mass., and director of the Harvard Project on Climate Agreements. David Biello is the environment and energy editor at Scientific American here in New York. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
You bet. Take care.